From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made just a week ago on this program. A cardiologist, Dr. Timothy Malins from Rochester Regional Health System, downplayed the likelihood that kids can go vegan with regularity. See, a new study finds that veganism can greatly impact childhood obesity. Dr. Malins cautioned, yes, that can absolutely be true, but it might not really be realistic on a wide scale. Well, the local vegan community contacted me. They were not thrilled with those comments. I heard from a number of people who wanted a chance at rebuttal. And so this hour, we get the response not only to those comments, but we're going to explore veganism from a number of angles. New dining options for people who are thinking about going vegan. What about those in lower socioeconomic circles? What's realistic? Kids in poverty, etc. What do the new studies show? What about diet recommendations that are coming our way? And more. My guest for the hour, Ted Barnett. It's been a little while since, it's been a few weeks
since
I've seen
you.
A couple of weeks. Yeah. And he's the head of the Rochester Area Vegan Society, RAVS, as they call it, right? Mm-hmm. And nice to see you again,
nice
by the way.
Nice to see you, yeah.
Aaron Frazier's here. You are 26 years old. You've been vegan for the last 3 years, right?
That's correct.
All right, we're going to talk about your decision to go vegan coming up here.
Okay, sounds good.
If you don't mind. Andrea Peros is here, and Andrea is the owner of The Red Fern, which is what, Andrea?
The Red Fern is a entirely vegan with gluten-free options restaurant here in Rochester.
All right, and Pam Hathaway is here. She's the owner of Vive Bistro and Bakery, brand new, as in a week old, right?
A week old. We just opened last Monday, yep.
And what are you?
We are French-inspired vegan.
French-inspired vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Barnett was the one who said, you've got to check this out. Have you checked it out yet?
Absolutely, yeah. Terrific.
How is it for you?
Oh, that's an amazing restaurant, as is Andrea's restaurant. The Red Fern is also terrific. Well, we're having, actually, RAVS is having their annual restaurant fundraiser on April 12th at Vive. So when they're open for dinner, we're going to be crashing the place. We have actually two seatings, 5:30 and 7:15. You can check out our website if you want to get tickets for that event.
Now, I have to say, someone contacted me on Twitter this morning when I was teasing the show and mentioned that, you know, the cardiologist response and some of the response I got from the vegan community. And somebody said, boy, vegans just are not happy people. I said, Dr. Barnett must be the happiest person I know. You're always smiling. You're a happy person, aren't you?
I'm extremely happy.
What's with this reputation that vegans are unhappy? That's I don't see that. But right. Do you hear that?
I think some people who are aware of the ethical issues and are doing it just, if you're looking behind the scenes a lot, you can get a little cranky. But, we have to be looking on the bright side. And in fact, one of my favorite quotes is, I'm going to get the guy wrong, but the quote is, be happy though you have considered all the facts.
Right. Well, in other words, don't be blind to injustice, but be happy that we can have our own role in hopefully being productive and helping solve it. How's that?
That's terrific.
There's a spin on that. And by the way, that's coming from your host, who is a non-vegan, but with much love for a vegan approach. And look, if you listen to Connections with any regularity, you know that in the last year, we have covered in many, many ways the ethical decisions that we all have to make when we decide the way animals are housed, the way animals are treated. I've admitted and I've said before, I think there's a good chance we'll look back in a generation or two or less and be embarrassed about things like gestation crates and the way animals are treated, et cetera. All of those considerations are in my mind, and what we want to do this hour is talk about what veganism is, what it isn't, and how accessible it is. Our restaurant hosts here, are you a guest here? Are you vegan or are you vegan providers? Yes?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yes
vegan.
And yes. So we've got a room full of four vegans and me. So I wonder if they'll convert me by the end of it here. I want to listen to the soundbite that kind of brought us to this place. So this is a week ago, and the background to this is that we know that childhood obesity remains a problem. The Cleveland Clinic put together their own study on this, and I want to get to some of the details on that in a moment, but they found that there are significant benefits to kids who move into veganism, not the least of which is childhood obesity. And I brought this up with Dr. Malins, a cardiologist, and let's listen to his response.
If you can do it, it's probably, there's truth to it. I mean, you're going to really reduce, I mean, if you're eating the right plants and the good fatty acids that that are in the majority of these plants, then you're doing okay. The problem is that it's really not a realistic solution to kids. I mean, it's very hard to. I tried doing, just as an experiment, I tried doing a vegan diet for 6 weeks, and it was extremely hard for me. And I have a lot of resources. I think trying to, although I think it's a good recommendation, but realistically, are we going to be able to do that? And I think the way we are, and the cost of doing that, and the having to avoid a lot of things, although I suspect it would decrease cholesterol and decrease obesity, putting the metal or the rubber to the road on that across the country would be very, very difficult.
Dr. Barnett.
I actually find that a very optimistic statement on his part, because here he is acknowledging the value of a vegan diet, a healthy vegan diet, and pointing out that there are obstacles to getting there. But I think we've passed the point of being questioned about whether it's a smart thing to do. Now the question is whether we can or should do it. And I've got the executive summary of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee in front of me. And in their second paragraph, they talk about there's two fundamental realities. First, about half of all adult Americans, or 117 million, have one or more preventable chronic diseases. And about two-thirds of U.S. adults, nearly 155 million, are overweight or obese. So we have a crisis in this country. We have a crisis. And, you know, when you have a crisis, you need to make changes. And I think we, the people around this table, have made these changes and are quite happy with the changes they've made. And I'd like to hear from them about how they think it would be possible.
I would like to hear from them in a moment, but yeah. I can't let you off the hook that easily there, Dr. Barnett.
Okay.
You're saying that's an optimistic view on the doctor's part, but he's saying, I'm a man of resources, right, maybe more than most.
Mm-hmm.
And in 6 weeks, I really couldn't even keep going with it. You know, it was tough for me. How would kids do it? Especially how would kids in lower socioeconomic circles do it? That is not optimistic.
Well, okay.
He might say that's realistic.
Okay, I'll grant you that it is realistic to say that we have an uphill battle. But we live in a toxic environment for children at this time in history. I mean, we're surrounded by incredible messages on the media all the time that we're embarrassed to see with our children around us, and I don't have to go into detail, but you know what's on the internet and on television. I mean, when I was growing up, you could leave your kid in front of the TV, and it was a good babysitter because you knew they weren't going to see anything you'd be horrified by. Now you can't leave them there, right? So as far as food goes, we have this incredible system in place now with fast food chains that are pushing basically non-food on our kids. And they have grown up thinking that that's food. When you show kids now a vegetable, they look at it like, wow, what is this? It's not in a bag. It doesn't have a wrapper around it. What is this? And we have our work cut out for us. But we don't have any choice because this is not a sustainable system we have in place. There's not enough people, healthy people now, to take care of all the sick people we're going to have in the next 20 or 30 years. In fact, if you look at the most recent statistics, children born after the year 2000 have a 1 in 3 chance of developing type 2 diabetes, and in the African American and Hispanic communities, it's 1 in 2 will develop type 2 diabetes. So, one way or another, the problem is going to get solved because we can't. It's not sustainable.
Are you disappointed to hear a cardiologist say, "Yeah, it's great, but probably not realistic"?
I'm not surprised. I've heard it before. I've heard a number of cardiologists say, "Oh yeah, if you can go on a low fat vegan diet, that's the best thing possible," but no one can do it. So, you know. I think patients who have heart disease now should be made aware of that as an option, because there's just no question that it works. As far as how to, you know, change things for the next generation, well, as adults, we have that responsibility. No, it's not going to be easy, but I think that the new Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee recommendations certainly start to address that. They talk about cutting back on, you know, sugars and red meat and processed meat, and increasing fruits and vegetables. And, you know, I think we're going to have to start taking that seriously.
All right. Now, we often talk about voting with our wallet on this program, that when you're making a purchase, you are essentially voting your values and you're voting with your wallet. At the same time, businesses are making decisions based on what the market wants. So I doubt we'd see Viv and the Red Fern if there isn't a demand for this. The notion that it can't be done. Well, Pam, I'm going to start with you.
Mm-hmm.
Viv is designed to reach people who are doing it. It is a French vegan
That's a contradiction in terms.
Well, no, I don't know that it's a contradiction. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that's very interesting. Who's walking through Veev's door? Who do you want to walk through Veev's door?
Everyone. Veev is available for everyone, whether they're vegan or not. You know, our whole concept is to get people to open their eyes to what's on their plate and realize that there's flavor in real food.
And where are you?
We are at 130 East Avenue on the corner of Sayo and East.
Okay. And so you've been open a week, and you're going to be open for lunch and dinner?
Yeah. Currently, we're open from lunch from 11 to 3, 7 days a week. In about 6 weeks, we hope to be open for dinner as well.
Okay. And so is the menu a diverse menu, as in not just vegan?
No, it is completely 100% vegan.
Okay, so it is vegan. Mm-hmm. And I guess the point is, when you said you want vegan and non-vegans to come in, non-vegans can come in and eat a vegan meal.
Right.
But what are you engaging in conversations with people? Do you want to talk about what they're eating?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm part of our purpose is to educate people as to what is on their plate.
Okay, so that's part of the story of Veev. The Red Fern has been around for how long?
About a year and a half now.
All right, so still relatively new. And where are you?
We are 283 Oxford Street at the corner of Oxford and Park.
Okay, what's the mission there?
The mission there is to make vegan food accessible to the masses. So we've kept in mind the affordability of the food, and also the menu was designed with using a lot of things that people are accustomed to eating, but making the vegan version. So, for example, we have a vegan mac and cheese. We have a vegan lentil loaf that's styled after a meatloaf with mashed potatoes and gravy and sautéed kale. Quesadilla, nachos, sandwiches, salads, things that people are already accustomed to eating, but vegan versions.
What do you think when you heard the cardiologist comment saying, yes, absolutely positive potential benefits, but probably not all that realistic?
Actually, I'd love to ask him what was so difficult for him when he was trying to eat for 6 weeks. What were the difficulties? Was it like a mental addiction to protein? I think that you see that a lot in society with bodybuilding and things like that. You know, a lot of people, I think, are mentally addicted to protein. Everyone always asks us, well, where do you get your protein? I mean, we're all fine. We've been doing this for years, and we're healthy, you know. So I think there's this addiction to protein in our society.
I've heard, by the way, from some other folks in preparation for this show, issues with iron. Is iron an issue on a vegan diet, Dr. Burnett?
Not really. No? I mean, there's vegetable sources of iron. I mean, where does, you know, think about the vegan creatures out there, like gorillas, which are closely related to us. They don't become iron deficient. They're vegans. They're living on fruits and vegetables. Green leafies are loaded with those kinds of things.
What was the campaign that convinced gorillas to go vegan? What did they do?
Evolution.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of evolution, Aaron Frazier, your own personal evolution took you into veganism 3 years ago. You're 26 now.
That's correct.
And, you know, I will say, I wanted the youngest person we could find to join this panel as well. And I don't know a lot of kids in their teens who are vegan. And I'm sure there are. I'm sure.
Our kids. We've been doing it for 24 years.
All right. So I'm sure there are Rab's kids, no question about it. But when you're 23, what pushed you to go that way?
So, well, first let me say, when I was in elementary school, I had an elementary school teacher who was fond of telling us that for every hour of television we watch, an angel dies. So I tell you that because I think it's analogous to what ultimately caused my conversion. It was information. I learned that my dietary choices in terms of consuming animals had huge, tragic repercussions on the environment, on the animals, and ultimately my own health. So I took an animal rights class at the Cornell Law School with Professor Sherry Kolb, and she walked us through the moral aspects of consuming animal products, the environmental aspects of consuming animal products, and the health effects of consuming animal products. And we also looked at hard animal rights cases or animal abuse cases. And my eyes were opened. I had an epiphany. And I think one of the things that really struck me is that somehow Professor Kolb, she got her hands on images and video footage of some things that go on in slaughterhouses and factory farms. And I was really shocked to learn that a lot of these things that we were seeing were perfectly legal under our so-called, quote-unquote, humane treatment laws, mm-hmm. these things that happened to these animals. So I really just had an epiphany, and that was it for me. So I got the information. So going back to the analogy with the TV and the angels dying, I mean, if for purposes of argument, if for purposes of a thought experiment, it was true that for every hour of television we watched an angel died, you know, we would find some other way to pass the time. So that's essentially what I did on my road to veganism. I found out, okay, there's this huge cost to consuming animals, not just to me, but to the environment, to everybody around me as well. So I just made the switch. I went cold turkey, excuse the pun, and I've been going strong since.
If you want to join the conversation, we have got a pile of comments already coming in online and on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And I'm going to start moving through those. Some very interesting comments already. 844-295-TALK to call the program toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Jake wants to correct the record. He says gorillas do eat some insects.
All right. Okay. I stand corrected.
There we are.
That may be a source of B12. Is that a source of much iron?
I could not get any gorilla to come in and talk to us about it, but there, that point's made. David says, this is perfect. My 7-year-old is vegan. She'd eat nothing but PB&J if up to her. Mm-hmm. I guess that would count if you just eat PB&J.
Yeah, that's certainly vegan.
Rory on Twitter, and I think this is a good point here. We've got our friends from the Red Fern, from the brand new Vive. That does not encompass nearly everything. What I wanted to bring about is a program that shows us a number of different angles here. But Rory says, don't forget about the all-vegan establishment Natural Oasis on 288 Monroe Avenue, commonly overlooked.
Thank you for pointing that out.
So Natural Oasis on Monroe Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's a good point, Rory.
Absolutely, and if I could interject on that, there are also vegan options at other restaurants. For instance, Dogtown, you can get
Owl House, Tap and Mallet.
Okay, so this is not a comprehensive look.
Right.
It's a look at a couple of the new ones, and so that's in many ways why Andrea and Pam are here. Stephen writes, waiting to hear how these restaurants in affluent areas can benefit the poor folks by providing vegan foods. That's a larger problem, but I take the point that Stephen is raising. It's socioeconomics can be tough. So let me start there before I get to the phones, and I see they're starting to ring. Let me start with the socioeconomics, and I'll start here with Dr. Barnett. Yes or no, it is harder for people who are in lower socioeconomic circles to go vegan.
Well, I'm not really an expert, but the people around me are shaking their heads that it's not harder.
I mean, that's the common assumption.
Of course it's common. But think about rice and beans. I mean, they're just as inexpensive as you can get. And it is true that a lot of people in lower socioeconomic groups live where there's not good supermarkets around. And that's an unfortunate reality. But that doesn't mean that they should be, you know, eating toxic food. And unfortunately, that's, you know, around them. I don't think anybody would argue that what's around them, even the non-vegan food, is healthy. It's mostly, you know, fast food chains that are junk by anybody's standards.
Sure. And so for a dollar, you can maybe get I was going to use a brand name term. I don't seek to insult. For a dollar, you can get a 700-calorie, you know, burger made from an aging dairy cow in who knows what conditions. But that's 700 calories. It fills you up, et cetera. Right. And it's a buck. Mm-hmm. Start me on this path that will help people who don't have money.
I think we need to understand where this comes from. So let's look at how the government subsidizes food in this country. We subsidize, 75% of subsidies go to meat and dairy. 0.3% go to fruits and vegetables. I'll say it again. 75% go to meat and dairy. 0.3% go to fruits and vegetables, which are the healthy things that we want people to be eating. So when people say, why is it so cheap to eat this hamburger, there's part of your explanation. In addition to that, we're also chopping down the rainforest to grow those things. But there are some sort of government introduced artifacts in there that have caused some of these healthier foods to be more expensive. And there's no question about that. But I still think it can be done. I'm not the cook in our house. My wife is. So I'm not the expert on this.
Okay. And we're going to go around the table on this because I know everybody wants to jump in. But part of your point seems to be, let's not dismiss it out of hand, but let's also look at U.S. food policy.
Absolutely.
That subsidizes, in your view, an unbalanced way.
If anybody wants to read the Farm Bill with me sometime, I'd be happy to sit down for a couple of weeks. Because it's about the most complicated document ever produced, right? Yeah. So,
well.
And all full of all kinds of subsidies and crazy, you know, government-introduced biases. So, I think I'll leave it at that.
All right, Pam Hathaway, owner of Vive Bistro and Bakery. When you hear people say it's not for everybody, it can't be afforded by everybody. No,
I disagree. I mean, how cheap is it to buy a box of spaghetti and a can of sauce? You know, there's a $3 meal right there that could feed a whole family.
Okay, Andrea.
Yeah, I mean, we could go through the list of all the different. Like rice or, you know, split peas, lentils, any of these things, they're all very, very cheap when you get them in dry form or even in canned form. I don't think there's an excuse. I think people are kind of looking to cover up the fact that they just maybe don't want to make that change, that the change is difficult and it's challenging some things about themselves. So that's an excuse.
Okay, Aaron?
We have an elderly relative in my family, and he's fond of telling us about how rough he had it. He tells my siblings and my cousins, and one of the things that he likes to say is that when he was young, he only had two meals a day, oatmeal and cornmeal. So these foods exist. They're vegan. And I just want to walk you, I mean, I grew up underprivileged myself. Luckily, through the power of education, I was able to transcend that and become a lawyer. So I'm doing pretty well now. But I've still kind of stuck to that frugality that I had to have as a child in order to survive. My family instilled in me. So I just want to walk you through my day. You know, I'm a 26-year-old single guy. I don't know how to cook. So a lot of things, it's either got to be ready-made or it's got to be someplace where I can get it quick. So for breakfast usually for me is either some plain oatmeal, maybe sprinkle some raisins in there, or some bran cereal with some soy milk, or maybe some grits. And then I'll go to work at Harris Beach, and Harris Beach has a wonderful cafe called Cafe 99, and the workers in the cafeteria go all out. I mean, they go above and beyond the call of duty in making sure that I have a very diverse menu from which to choose. So, I mean, one day they'll make me a very, very special vegan soup, and then they'll make enough for everybody so that everybody can sample it. I usually like to get a nice vegan wrap, a spinach wrap, and throw some lettuce, tomato, black olives, avocado, and all that good stuff in there. For dinner, I'll probably stop by a restaurant and grab something, or if I'm running tight, I'll buy some frozen vegan dinners from Wegmans or something, then stick it in the oven when I get home. And so probably in any one day, I probably between breakfast, lunch, and dinner, maybe $15 to $20.
Okay, so we're going to look at, and by the way, the phones are all lit up now. We're going to get back to the phones in a second. Your perspective is interesting because, again, you're not somebody who is now in adulthood thinking food's always been whatever I wanted, no matter the cost, no matter, you know, the inconvenience. You did grow up with tougher choices.
Right.
So you're used to the challenge. But I want to get to somebody who can tell me about what the challenges are. John in Rochester says he tried veganism but failed. This is John. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Yeah, probably about, I would say 20 years ago, I tried to become a vegan, and it lasted about 6 months. And I had this craving for red meat. And honest to God, I went off the vegan diet, went back to the red meat, and now I crave red meat even more. In fact, I used to have it done medium, my steaks. Now I have a medium rare. So there's something, I guess my question would be, is there something inherent in the genetic makeup of the human that they're carnivores?
John, it's a good question, and I think that's a good question. Or is protein or meat essentially addictive in a way that sugar or caffeine would be, Doctor?
Well,
and Dr. Burnett, sure. By the way, as I keep calling him Doc, you are a radiologist by trade, is that right?
Interventional radiologist.
An interventional radiologist, right. And the
high-tech doctor with low-tech solutions.
Okay, but in this way, again, I don't want to, you're not offering the perfect medical answer for every single question.
Sure.
But when it comes to his question, first of all, is it in our DNA to be carnivores?
Can I just ask a question of the listener? Why did he become a vegan?
Oh, sorry, I've already lost John.
Okay. Is it in our DNA? Well, I don't think you can make a case for that. I think you can make a case that during human evolution, we at times had to eat animal products because there were times when there was no other food available. And that's one of the reasons that humans were able to spread across the globe. But we live in the modern world now where we certainly don't need that type of food for survival. So the question is, are we predisposed to, are we genetically designed to have meat? No, the answer is not. And I haven't had meat for 24 years. My kids have never had meat, and they're fine.
It sounds to me like he went through withdrawal the same way some people do when they quit coffee, cigarettes, when they try to greatly reduce sugar intake. Is there any evidence that we know of that meat is addictive in any form that would actually create a physical symptom like that?
I'm not sure about that, actually.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but I do think that I have something to add that will be responsive to the caller's question and concern. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Milton Mills. He's an African-American vegan. He goes around the country giving speeches, and one of his big subjects is that human beings are, in fact, herbivores. And he makes a number of compelling arguments, I think, to sustain that. So first, he argues that the anatomy of the human being, we have much more in common with your stereotypical or quintessential herbivore than your carnivore. Like if you compare us to a deer, for example, and then you compare us to a lion, if you look at the structure of our jaw, the fact that our canines aren't as pronounced, if you look at the length of our esophagus, the various chemicals that make up the digestive processes within our stomach, the length of our intestines and all that stuff, we have a lot more in common with the herbivores than the carnivores. He also makes a psychological argument. When a lion kills something, it doesn't really have this apprehension toward blood and gore, whereas most humans, we do have that natural repulsion toward blood and gore. So that wouldn't really make sense if we are carnivores, if we were designed to be predators, designed to eat meat. Now, going to the eating meat, like you need it. If you stop doing it for a while,
did you go through any withdrawal?
No, because I thank Sherry Cope, Professor Sherry Cope, because she had a full. The class was phenomenal. It was plenary, everything that we needed. Because the mistake that I think that a lot of people make when they convert to veganism is they make the switch, but they're still not trying. They're still not taking into consideration the various nutrients and vitamins that they need to get within them. So this person, if I had to speculate, I would think the caller probably converted to a vegan diet, but he didn't compensate with vegetables or other vegan friendly items that allow sufficient iron or sufficient protein. He wasn't replacing the meat that he was losing, or replacing the nutrients that he usually got from meat with vegetable sources or vegan friendly sources.
You're getting a lot of nods around the table here. Andrea, do you need to go in with more of a plan if you're going to go vegan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of times people think, you know, vegan diet, okay, so maybe I have, you know, oatmeal for breakfast, then I have a sandwich for lunch, and then pizza or pasta for dinner. Right there, you're looking at all starches. You're not really looking at a lot of vegetables. You definitely have to have a plan. Lentils are a great source of iron, and I think that would be a good recommendation for that caller or for other people that are going through these withdrawals. You know, lentils are a great source for things like that.
You became vegan when?
In 2008.
And hardest part for you was what?
I didn't have a hard time. When I went vegetarian earlier than that, and my family never ate a lot of meat growing up, so I didn't really have a huge transition. People often say, oh, I'd go vegan, but I don't want to give up the cheese. At the time, I had an allergy to cheese, and that was part of my transition. So I never really had to go through that.
Okay. Pam, you went vegan when?
2 years ago.
Okay. 2 years ago?
Yep.
Hardest part for you was what?
Nothing. I had also been vegetarian for almost, 12 years. Okay. So it was really no transition for me.
See, Dr. Barnett, you talk to people in the classes that you host,
right.
and I think some people go in with the idea that it is going to be hard, and they may be hearing our panel today and thinking, you're oversimplifying.
Well, actually, going back to that caller's question, I wonder if he really used the word vegan correctly, or maybe he didn't go vegetarian. If he was ovo-lacto-vegetarian, he was eating a lot of dairy, then you can actually have an iron problem, because dairy has no iron. And he may have been craving the iron in meat. I don't know. So 20 years ago is a long time ago to have become vegan. So I wonder if there was some confusion about that. And people should realize that it's actually tough if you're just consuming a lot of dairy to get enough iron.
It's our vegan rebuttal hour here on Connections with the panel talking about their own experiences, the options that are out there, and answering your calls. I'm late for a break, but we are going to be coming back to the phones in a moment here. Brian in Greece, Rachel in Rochester, Alan in Rochester. We're coming to you when we come back from this break, and we're also going to talk about when you do hear vegans talk about the ethical approach to it and the decisions they make. We're going to talk about a little bit more of that as well. So stay tuned right here on Connections on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. To the phones we go with our panel. In studio is Dr. Ted Barnett, head of the Rochester Area Vegan Society. Ravs is online where?
It's rochesterveg.org, and my wife and I co-coordinate the society. It's
He's a wise man. He's wise to point out. Aaron Frazier's here talking about his experience going vegan at the age of 23. Andrea Peros is the owner of The Red Fern in Rochester. Pam Hathaway, owner of Vive Bistro and Bakery, brand new, just a week old in Rochester. This is Rachel in Rochester. Go ahead, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I am 26. I've been vegan for 7 years. I went vegan when I was a teenager, I guess, technically. I guess I just wanted to say when I went vegan, I actually worked at the zoo in education, and I would kind of, you know, talk to the kids about all the animals, and I sort of came to the realization myself that I didn't want to eat them. After that, I worked in education at the Humane Society. And one of my favorite things about teaching kids is that they seem so open to it. You know, unless they've been raised in an environment where people are hurting animals, they intrinsically know that they don't want to hurt animals. They don't want to do anything that's going to hurt someone else. So I guess that's my point.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Panel, want to jump in here? Dr. Barnett?
Oh, that's a great point. I mean, our kids certainly grew up with that message, and the thought of hurting animals horrifies them. So, yeah, and it's natural for kids.
Well, there's a couple of points that kind of build on Rachel's point here online. First of all, on Twitter, Chris writes, "I don't believe that anyone would agree with how animals are raised in modern society so that we can eat dairy and meat. One video of a factory farm, and I went from eating a cheeseburger the day before to vegan. Over 3 years, and I have not looked back." That's from Chris on Twitter. But Dan writes, so many thoughts here. Is it an omnivorous diet or a sedentary diet that leads to obesity? What types of things did your one guest see that caused him such disgust to cause an epiphany? Is he painting with a broad brush and think that it happens everywhere? I think he might be talking about you, Aaron. I don't know. You want to respond to that?
I think he was talking about me as well. Well, I mean, I don't know how graphic we want to get. So people say I have no filter. So I'll trust my colleagues here to filter me if it gets too graphic. I mean, some of the images, you know, because there's a profit motive behind the meat industry.
Behind every industry,
right,
that I know,
right.
But meat being one of them, yes.
Right. So they're looking to save on production costs where they can, and one way that you do that is with space. You
Absolutely.
Pack the animals as tightly as possible. But with any sentient being, any being that's capable of feeling pleasure and pain, they're not going to like being cramped all that much. When you do that, they're either going to start self-mutilating or mutilating each other. So one way that the meat industry has come up, one solution that they've employed to deal with this is to take away either the parts of the animal's bodies that either are actually doing the harm, or take away the parts of the animal's bodies that are producing the chemicals that cause them to have this behavior. So what you see, for example, with chickens is that sometimes they'll use a press to remove the chicken's beaks so that they won't peck each other. They'll also remove the testicles of pigs and cows and in some places to reduce the amount of testosterone and aggression that these animals exhibit.
Without anesthesia.
Right, right. All of this without anesthesia. I saw one video in the animal rights class where after some sort of hurricane happened, the farm was destroyed. So rather than relocating the chickens, they threw them all in the dumpster and then gassed them with CO2, I believe. These are the things that they're allowed to do. Those are the types of things that I saw. I mean, there was one image that particularly got to me where there was a line leading cows into a slaughterhouse, and there was one cow in line, and if I could read the cow's mind, it knew what was coming, and it was struggling so hard to turn around, but the pathway was so thin that the cow couldn't turn around, but it was just struggling so hard to try to turn around and go backwards in the line to avoid the slaughterhouse. It was just a line of cows, single file, being led into a slaughterhouse, and just this one cow, you could see it, on its face, to the extent that a cow has a facial expression.
All right, so those are the things that moved you.
Right.
And to Dan's question about whether it's an omnivorous diet or a sedentary lifestyle that makes the human race gain weight the way we have, Dr. Barnett, what do you think?
Well, you can't point to one thing. It's complicated. It's probably both. We certainly have, I wouldn't call the current American diet necessarily omnivorous. I would call it junk food based. I mean, we have so much horrible food that people are eating now. If you look at we told people back in the 1970s, cut back on fat consumption. And in fact, the percentage of calories from fat has gone down minimally, but the actual amount of fat that people are eating is about the same. What happened was we're consuming about 500 more calories a day than we were in 1970. So we're eating 500 calories more a day. We're also sedentary. The kind of calories that we're taking in are, cheese, processed white flour products, lots of oils, sugars. I mean, it's just amazing that people would think that, we could actually survive on that kind of food. You wouldn't feed it to your farm animals, for example, because they wouldn't do well. And it's had this incredibly devastating effect on us as humans with obesity and chronic diseases.
Michael in Rochester. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Evan, Dr. Barnett and Edward Carroll have some great classes to learn about this. And I'm not totally vegan, but probably 90 or 95% in that direction. And mushrooms are one of those things that can give you the so-called umami sensation that meat is often associated with, or bacon.
Oh, yeah.
And mushrooms are just a fabulous source of nutrients. And we have Smugtown mushrooms locally. There's other local mushrooms available. And people shouldn't go forage for them because it can be dangerous, but mushrooms are a great source of nutrients. And there's a great article in the New York Times recently about the nutrient deficiency of food that we have now, because we take the nutrients out, then we add some of them back in, and that people are craving the nutrients, so they're eating too much because their food doesn't have enough and as wide a range of nutrients in it. So that was just this past week in the New York Times.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, thanks for that call.
How about mushroom cooking? Michael, by the way, have you been to Veeve or the Red Fern?
I have not. It's on my top of my list to go to next. I can't wait to try it.
If I know the voice I'm hearing, there's very few people who know the food scene like Michael. And so, Michael, thanks for the call and great points.
Thank you.
Mushroom cooking, Pam?
Yeah.
At Veeve?
Yeah. We've got a portobello sandwich. We've got mushrooms all over the menu.
Andrea?
I'm glad you mentioned Smugtown mushrooms. We use their mushrooms a lot. They grow all kinds, shiitake, lion's mane. They also do oyster mushrooms. We often use those for our daily specials.
Question from David on Twitter. How about venison? What would the humane or environmental argument be against eating an animal that has few natural predators and is overpopulated?
May I say?
You may, please.
Well, so there's this whole argument out there called species control. We have to hunt, we have to farm animals in order to control their species. But that's a bit, at least in my mind, that's a bit like me going into your house and then trying to eliminate you, saying there are too many of you in this house. It's we have to come to a certain, we as human beings have to come to a certain sort of equilibrium, just like every other species on this planet does. And I don't, if we're invading, if we're at an alarming rate, the territories and habitats of other animals, I don't, it's a false argument. It's a false argument saying that we can go in and then, because now we're there, they're posing a problem to us. I think we have to find a way to come into equilibrium, just like they are. So it's in my mind, that's a false argument saying that we need to, it's a matter of species control, or we need to keep these animals under control, and the best way to do that is to kill them and eat them.
Well, you realize, Aaron, you're opening up the next conversation, which is coming on my show either later this week or next week, which is population and whether we do need to think more seriously about our own future. I mean, when you ask people to think long-term in this country, they think, what, 20 years, 30 years? They're not thinking 100, and they're definitely not thinking 1,000 years. We've got more than 7 billion people on the planet. Eventually, we could have 15 or 20 billion people on the planet if nothing changes. I don't know that that's sustainable.
Right.
But that's sort of what you're talking about here, isn't it? That we kind of think, well, you know, we're the dominant species. We will. That's just sort of the natural order.
Yeah, we're going to have to come to terms with that eventually, and that's a very important discussion that we need to have. But staying on this topic, the other part of it, too, is that we ourselves are the reason for a lot of the existence of a lot of these animals. We're breeding them specifically to eat them. So it's not like they're just going crazy and reproducing. We're the ones causing them to come into existence specifically for the purpose of raising them to kill them and then eat them. So it's not at least not with all of these animal species. It's not this natural overproduction of the animal. A lot of times we are the ones doing it because it's so marketable.
All right, we're talking veganism. I'm starting to have the panic of a host who knows we can't come close to getting through all of the calls and comments that are coming in, which just shows the interest in this, by the way. But we're going to get to the phones in a second. If we come to you, let's try to keep it brisk as best we can. Dan follows up on Twitter to say he grew up on a dairy farm, and a lot of this hits close to home. Certainly mistreatment happens, but he and a lot of other people he knew treated their animals like queens. And I would just say, Dan, I know there are local farmers who do. We've talked about that on this program, and as a non-vegan on this panel who has a great appreciation for veganism, I would just say to Dan and people like you, thumbs up on that. At least that's the next step, is saying, if we're going to eat animals, do we care if they suffer or not? And I know people like Dan do, because Olive says on Twitter, if we can live healthfully without harming animals, why shouldn't we? But Mindy wants to talk about, I think, pescatarianism. Mindy, is that right?
My question, what would be your critique against the diet of fruits, vegetables, and fish, mainly salmon, for the protein you get from salmon? What's your critique against such a diet?
Mindy, thanks very much. So fruits, vegetables, fish. What's the critique against eating fish, Dr. Barnett?
Well, so there's a couple of points. One is, she was talking about protein as if fish was the only source of protein, or animal products are the only good source of protein. And we know that's not true. For protein, that's like the least of America's problems. We have plenty of protein. We're rolling in it. We can get it from beans, lentils. Broccoli is 44% calories from protein. We can get it everywhere. So I don't think we need to get our protein from fish. There are some advantages to cold water salmon that certainly people make that point. But, you know, the world's fisheries are in complete collapse. And Evan's already made the point about the world population being at 7 billion. There's really no way that we can feed fish to everybody on the planet. And I think it's unwise to make a health recommendation based on the idea that everyone needs to eat fish to be healthy, because it's just not possible. And it's only possible for a small fraction of Americans to eat fish.
Jim and Penyan is a small dairy farmer with some different ideas here. Jim, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Evan. You got a good show. I just wanted to say I'm an organic dairy farmer. Big belief in sustainability, too. And, just some of the comments kind of irk me. And, try to think of a kid growing up without milk and cheese. It just doesn't seem right. And, and also to think of how we've evolved. I mean, for mankind to evolve without eating meat, as we never would have made it. There's so much nutrients that you get from red meat that our ancestors never would have made it without.
I don't think Dr. Barnett disagrees with that point. You've acknowledged that evolutionarily we needed it.
Well, we needed to survive the rough patches in our, you know, where we're migrating across the globe. But there's certainly places on the planet where nobody eats red meat, right? And there are the blue zones, for example, Okinawa of Japan, you know, where basically that's grain-based. There's no dairy there at all. I mean, there are people all over the world who grow up without ever having milk or cheese. And I respect what you do. I don't have a problem with what you do. I think it's great that you're organic, and obviously you're taking good care of your animals. I respect that.
I don't agree with, modern industrial agriculture. I think that's got to change completely. Otherwise, you know.
Jim, what's your operation, Jim?
I'm related to Kloss and Mary Howell, which have Lakeview Organic Grain and Penn Yam.
Oh, very good. Okay.
So I just have a small dairy farm, yeah.
Well, we're not afraid to mention who you are and what you do, and we're glad you called, and I appreciate you listening. And I think one of the hard parts of this conversation is, you know, Jim is obviously someone who works very hard, is trying to do things the right way, but a lot of what I hear from people who are vegan is that, look at the human species. We are drinking milk from other animals, and we don't see other species doing that. Look, I've got cream in my coffee. So, Jim, you know, you've got a host here who I'm against the grain in this studio a little bit. But is it fair to say that there is something at least thought-provoking about us being a species that drinks the milk from another species?
Oh, for sure. There's.
But is it automatically problematic?
Is it automatically problematic? Well, it's a complex question, but you have to look at how dairy is treated in this country in particular. It's has this vaunted, very protected position. If you go to the USDA's website to find out how much of various nutrients you're supposed to eat or how much of various kinds of food you're supposed to eat, and you put in your weight, your height, it'll tell you how many calories you're supposed to consume, and that will you'll get a number of cups of beans, whatever. Everything will go up and down except for the dairy, which will always be 3 cups. It'll come up 3 cups whether you are 100 pounds or 500 pounds. There's no variation, and that's because of very successful lobbying by the dairy industry. And I think that we have to go a long way to break down that grip that they have. So I'm very concerned about dairy.
Go ahead, Darren.
Scientifically, based on my understanding, there is a debate about whether cow's milk is, at the end of the day, whether it does more harm than good or more good than harm. But conceptually, when you're putting something into a system that wasn't designed to take it, I don't think it's all that far-fetched to assume that that's going to cause some problems, especially when the consequence is what we're doing to these animals to get it. I've come across people who, perhaps facetiously, or some of them based on their demeanor when they said it seriously, thought that that vegans are against breastfeeding. That's not the case at all, at least not for most vegans that I know. Humans consuming human milk, that's fine. But so long as the science is out, so long as the jury is still out, I think it would be a more humanitarian, a more ethical approach to say, okay, well, if we can get by without it, without cow's milk, then let's try to do it. And I think that history has shown that we can get by without it. And that's, you know, going back to the previous caller's question about the salmon as well, because Ted gave us a very nice analysis on the science there, but I think there's a moral aspect to that question as well. If, like most people, we think that if we can avoid causing harm, then we have some sort of moral duty to do so, then I think that would be one answer to the salmon question. If we can get it, whatever it is that we think that we're getting from salmon, if we can get it from another source without causing the harm to the salmon and the harm to the oceans and other water sources that we have to do to get those salmon, then why not do it?
All right. Now, let me close on this point here. I read a piece that long piece in The Atlantic by Alexis Madrigal, and I would urge our audience to read it. It's all about the Great California Water Saga. It made me think of our vegan friends, and the piece talked about the real problems California is having with drought, water, and the fact that so much of our agriculture comes from California in this country. 4/5 of our almonds come from California, and California requires more water just for their almonds than Los Angeles needs in a year. It is remarkable, the water used for almonds. It made me want to eat only cashews, which really, let's be honest, we all should anyway, because cashew is like the evidence that God just stopped, was like, I got it. I got the nut thing down. It's obviously the best. But it made me rethink almonds. And then I think about spinach, and I think about all these other things that are grown out there in a desert in the Central Valley that require enormous amounts of water, and they don't have the water for it right now. Does that come up? Is that an ethical consideration?
Well, I think it is an ethical consideration. And if you're going to look at the ethics of where we get our food, you have to first start to look at where we get our meat and our dairy, because that is far more, has far more of an impact environmentally than I'm sure than the water that we're using.
Don't disagree.
Yeah, I mean, we're 90% of
the grains. But separating.
Sure, but 90% of the grains in this country are fed to animals, not to humans.
That's
so
right.
We could cut 90% of our grain crop, which obviously would have some economic dislocations if we did that, but we don't need to be producing all that grain for animals. We can be consuming it ourselves, and we can produce food locally.
So we can produce food essentially more locally. Mm. Does it change, Andrea and Pam, again, I don't mean to put you on the spot, you're restaurant owners, do you think about the resources required to grow some of our vegetables, and does it make you think twice at times?
Absolutely. Our menu, however, is based on the seasons as well as possible. I mean, we do live in Rochester, New York, so, you know. I mean, there are some things that are just not available unless you know.
But haven't we created a mindset in this country that if you walk into Wegmans that, damn it, on a Wednesday you want spinach and it's fresh, and I deserve it. I deserve asparagus all year round. I deserve fresh everything all year round. I don't know that that's a healthy mindset.
Well, I don't think you should blame vegans for that.
I'm not blaming vegans. I'm not blaming vegans. I'm wondering if vegans who love vegetables, just like I do, still say sometimes we shouldn't be able to get certain things. And that doesn't mean you don't have to be vegan.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think we need to be very careful about where these things are sourced, and we should be tuned into that.
If I go to the Red Fern, I know there are many, many options there. I was going to ask them their favorite menu items, but now we're going to have to look it up ourselves. Where's the Red Fern, Andrea?
On the web, you mean? Oh, okay. RedFernRochester.com.
RedFernRochester.com.
Yep, and Facebook and Instagram as well.
And Vive Bistro, where are you online?
ViveBistro.com.
Well, congrats on your 1 week. Andrea,
thank you.
Congrats on a year and a half.
Thank you.
Far from the only vegan options, as we're finding out. Aaron, fascinating talking to you. Thanks for sharing your experience.
My pleasure.
Dr. Barnett, again, we covered about half of what I wanted, so I guess we'll have to come back again and do it again.
I'm here for you.
Online, real quick, Revs, online, where?
RochesterVeg.org.
Thank you for being here. It's a happy crowd. It really is. Have a great Monday. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Val for doing the great work behind the glass, and we'll talk to you on a Tuesday.